Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with my panel this hour, Eli Sanders, associate editor of The Stranger. You still have a Pulitzer Prize, right?
They haven't taken it away yet.
Yeah. Great to see you again.
Nice to see you.
Your former Washington Attorney General, Rob McKenna. Hello, sir.
Hello, sir.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
From the Seattle Channel, always a pleasure, civic cocktail host Joni Balter.
And always a pleasure.
Let's talk about what happened this week and what we can learn from it, what it's really about. First of all, big projects go over budget. It would be surprising if they didn't. So, as you decide how to vote on light rail, how much should you mind that it is 86% over budget so far? Seattle Times reporter Mike Lindblom told me why when Sound Transit started this 20 years ago, they underestimated the cost.
The agency issued cost estimates with no experience behind them and with a real sense of desperation to get the measure passed. That leads to a sort of optimism bias where agencies don't account for what you might call the unknown unknowns. And this happens all over the world.
Well, it may happen all over the world, but that's outrageous, isn't it? Estimating costs with no experience in order to get it passed?
Well, there were some safeguards. There was an expert review panel looking at the information that Sound Transit consultants produced. Sound Transit, in its materials, told the public that the cost estimates were conservative and that they even expected to have money left over to get to Northgate. But it's taken us 20 years to find out what the final costs are going to be.
Now, there are many reasons for the overages, including rising real estate prices, trouble tunneling under Portage Bay. But those troubles came early. Light rail has been on budget lately, and nobody's accusing them of lowballing this time. It's a $54 billion ask of voters in November. So, how much should our listeners punish Sound Transit for old, broken promises? Rob McKenna?
Well, I think that the key here is that the voters have to have confidence in the new projections because these are breathtaking numbers. And the fact is that voters found out a long time ago, back in 2000, that the original estimates were way off. It's when the U.S. Department of Transportation Inspector General came in and saw that Sound Transit was blowing through all of its reserves and contingencies and was still way over budget. That led to a redrawing of the plan. That's why what's being built now in phase one is very different than what the voters approved. But the good thing about that was that that revised plan, which we adopted on the Sound Transit Board back in 2000, is the plan they're now implementing and are on budget for. So I think it's appropriate to look at the original promises because, you know, they may say something about the future. At the same time, Sound Transit performance more recently in this regard has actually been pretty close to target.
Right. And Eli, we're seeing people on trains.
Yeah,
and
we're getting
a lot of it.
Quite a good value for our investment. I mean, record ridership, especially on the new line from the University of Washington Station to Capitol Hill and on to downtown. And I think you have to look at the benefits of light rail, not just in terms of ease of transportation, but in terms of potentially declogging our freeways or helping to do that, helping the environment. You're spending billions, yes, but you are getting a lot of tangible, intangible, and frankly, hard to quantify future benefits for that $54 billion. I think it's a good investment.
On the topic of declogging, I always keep hearing a transportation planner types say, your freeways will always be about as clogged as they're ever going to be. If they were not clogged, people would drive on them so that they would be clogged.
Right. Well, maybe we should stop building freeways and build more transit then, because you are never experiencing a clogged freeway when you're riding mass transit.
Right.
Joni? So Mike Lindblom had a pretty important phrase in there. There was a sense of desperation to get the measure passed. And sometimes you feel that for a lot of things that are in front of voters, including this one that is coming here now, because there's this sense that I have that how dare anybody ask any questions about this giant funding package. And that, you know, something that we've talked about this week as well with State Senator Reuven Carlisle asking, is this the right funding package? Is this the right financing? I mean, one sort of motto Sound Transit could have is not as overpriced as Bertha.
So, as I said, no one's accusing them of lowballing this time, right?
Right.
$54 billion.
The way you were talking about how these sort of overruns are baked into the consciousness of the folks.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, but it's not as bad as Bertha. So, you know, we expected some overruns. 86%.
Yeah. And it's a valid discussion.
That's not sneezing.
It's a valid question to ask whether it's wise to adopt a plan by voter approval that goes out for so many decades. One of the reasons you have voter-approved plans is to create accountability. And if the voters don't get another bite at this apple for 35 years, question whether or not there's really accountability or not. So, that's one of the reasons that people who are concerned about the size of this plan cite for saying, let's have a smaller plan for the next phase, and then you can come back and ask us for approval of the next piece. Because it turns out that you're more motivated as an agency to deliver things on time and on budget when you know you have to go back sooner rather than later.
Yeah, may we all live long enough to be accountable for a 30-year plan. You mentioned this Senator Reuven Carlisle, a Democratic state senator, came out this week and said he's got a problem with the funding plan. Basically, it seems like he's saying if we suck up all this property tax money for Sound Transit, we won't have it to pay for education, which we have to somehow do.
That is essentially what he's saying, although when you get into the intricacies of our state tax policy, it gets a lot more complicated. But yes, Reuven Carlisle, who represents Ballard, which would get light rail extended to it under this new plan that we're voting on in November. Senator Reuven Carlisle says he has concerns, big concerns, about the financing package, and that we are basically taking away from our ability to fully fund our public schools under the McCleary obligation. That's the Supreme Court decision that said we are unconstitutionally underfunding our public schools, that by using so much property tax for light rail, we're taking away effectively the ability of politicians in Olympia to grab more property tax money for education. There are a lot of people who have come out and said that's a false choice, that we can do both, that actually Reuven Carlisle voted to approve this financing plan, which is true, before he came out against it. So there is a big, wonky tax debate going on about the financing for light rail. And yes, Reuven Carlisle is the one raising concerns.
We're not going to walk out about this really now, but isn't, Rob, basically the another argument is, yeah, we have a limited amount of money, so the way to light the fire under the legislature to figure out how to provide more money, and by the way, maybe a more progressive tax structure, is to say, yeah, you're out of money. Deal with it.
But that suggests that somehow this financing mechanism was an elaborate ploy to prod the legislature to think more deeply about adopting an income tax. Actually, it was part of a plan to come up with the money to finance a $15 billion plan. They had to find it somewhere. They took it from the state property tax. And for the listeners, just to be clear about this, the reason that implicates education funding is that we've understood the state property tax to be the tax which funds a big part of our public school costs. It's called the common school levy. It is an amount that has always been dedicated to education, and it had a whole bunch of unused capacity. In other words, the rate of the state property tax of the common school levy has been lower than what it could be under our constitutional limit on property taxes. And what Senator Carlisle is pointing out is that in moving a chunk of that unused capacity out and funding something else with it, it doesn't matter what it is, it's just not education, you're taking away that capacity, which frankly, the state is going to need in order to reform school levies, which right now unconstitutionally rely far too much on local levies instead of the state levy.
Joni, this train is departing the station. Got any final words on Sound Transit?
Yeah. Hold the train for a second. And
hold the train!
And let's just say three cheers to Reuven Carlisle for attempting to have a very important, nuanced conversation about this. You know, everybody thinks this is just simple, hey, thumbs up or thumbs down on light rail. And woe be to the person who doesn't say, wow, I'm so excited about light rail and $54 billion. He's raised an important question. One idea is, why not have some of the businesses around who are adding to the growth rather a lot pay some kind of tax or some kind of fee for light rail? What about that? Why isn't that on the table here? This is an important conversation for us to have.
And just to be clear, the choice is not property tax or income tax only. There's a lot of other possibilities out there just to kind of raise consciousness about it. There's a gas tax that we use way disproportionately for roads. Maybe you could dedicate some of the gas tax or more of it to mass transit, and then light rail wouldn't have to grab money from the property tax. Maybe we could have a capital gains tax, which has been talked about and taken seriously by conservatives. Maybe we could have an income tax. Maybe we could have a carbon tax. There are a lot of taxing possibilities to fund good and necessary services that we don't use because they're non-starters in the Republican-controlled Senate.
I've been holding this train door open, and it's really, really starting to squeeze.
All right, I'll jump in.
Thank you. Thank you. Coming up, safe spaces for students, for drug users, for dogs, and more on The Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review, thanks for tuning in. With school beginning soon, the University of Chicago has sent a letter to incoming freshmen that jumps right into the nationwide debate over campus sensitivity and speech. Quote, "Our commitment to academic freedom means that we do not support so-called trigger warnings. We do not cancel invited speakers because their topics might prove controversial, and we do not condone the creation of intellectual safe spaces where individuals can retreat from ideas and perspectives at odds with their own." Joni, you are a teacher, a mother of a UW Husky.
Oh, yeah.
You agree with the Chicago Dean, more or less.
Oh, yeah? Absolutely. I think that we are coddling students to a kind of a scary level. You know, in that story that we all read about what the University of Chicago is doing was this little tidbit that at Brown University, they had a discussion about a big debate about sexual assault. And afterwards, students created these safe spaces with counselors, bubbles, Play-Doh, and pillows. Now, if that doesn't sound, like coddling these students, I mean, I think if you treat students like they're fragile, they will be fragile. I think they can handle a whole lot more than we give them credit for.
I like bubbles and Play-Doh.
I actually have some bubbles on me, but go ahead.
Yeah.
Well, I know from experience that there are helpful safe spaces in the culture. A lot of conversation has gone on about gay bars as a safe space for people in the gay community, especially in the wake of the shooting in Orlando. But I think there's a difference between that and kind of an intellectual overprotectiveness that is what the University of Chicago is trying to get away from. Also, gay bars or any other similar space like that is privately held, quote-unquote, safe space. University of Chicago, I believe, is a publicly funded university in any way.
I don't think so.
No?
It's a private university.
Sorry.
Go on.
But anyway, I would say whether you're publicly funded or not, a university, a place of higher education should be about uncomfortable seeking of knowledge, and you can't always feel safe during that. That's just an unreasonable expectation.
I mean, the whole idea of higher education in part is to help you stretch your mind, to challenge your preconceptions, to get you to think differently or more openly about new ideas, even if you aren't entirely comfortable with them. It's interesting to see this story today because when I was in law school at the University of Chicago, one of the professors, Bloom, published a book called The Closing of the American Mind, and it was his long-winded complaint about students coming into colleges and universities in the mid-80s and late 80s, you know, already thinking they knew everything, you know, not always wanting to be polite. He complained they were too nice to each other and wouldn't question each other rigorously, et cetera. So I have to give credit to the University of Chicago for, you know, being consistent and speaking up for academic freedom, particularly at a time when a lot of educators say in anonymous surveys that they think that, for example, trigger warnings have a negative effect on academic freedom.
Well, here's the pro trigger warning argument that students can't learn unless they're ready to learn, and so you are letting people know, hey, this is what you're in for. And some people might not have had it so easy in their lives. I'm not saying you have. I don't know, but if someone has gone through something that makes a topic really difficult for them to approach, that a trigger warning can be welcoming to them and saying, okay, now let's get in. Now you've been trigger warned. Let's get into it.
I would just say if these students are watching the Trump campaign, they're ready for whatever material that I'm going to offer in a classroom.
Well, you know, there is room for common sense, too, which is to say that if you're going to be talking about really sensitive issues like sexual trauma, in a psychology course. You know, people should know what they're going to be hearing, what they're going to be in for. Maybe part of the problem here is boiling the whole concept down to a two-word phrase.
Yeah,
trigger warning.
Safe space.
Yeah, say so. All of a sudden, everyone on both sides of the debate or of the both ends of the ideological spectrum read into it all these terrible things or good things, depending.
But the syllabus says what's coming. If you can't handle what's coming, call in sick or not interested or whatever you want to call that.
There's also a difference, as Rob is saying, between a trigger warning and a safe space, and we kind of start to confuse things when they roll them all when we roll them all up into one and treat them all at once.
Right. The University of Chicago, it buried in here actually are a lot of qualifiers. They don't support so-called trigger warnings. We don't condone the creation of. So they're not saying that it's banned. We just saying we're not going to officially encourage it. The creation of intellectual safe spaces. Well, that's different from there. So they're not saying you can't have a club, a center that's only open to certain people. You know, well, what's an intellectual safe space? So there's some qualifiers.
I wonder whether or not University of Chicago is paying enough attention to maintaining its own history of ideological diversity among its faculty and in the curriculum itself. I'm not nearly as concerned about students having safe spaces or receiving trigger warnings as I am about, you know, homogeneous thinking, you know, among all the faculty. And I think the University of Chicago is still pretty good about avoiding that. I went to law school there in part because it was one of the few law schools at that tier of quality that had conservatives and liberals not only both there but actively engaging with each other. It had law and economics, and it had feminist jurisprudence intermixing, and it was a much more interesting place than going to Harvard Law School at the time, which was completely self-destructing over something called deconstruction of the law, and was all very left-wing. So that, to me, that's the more important point, even in these issues of trigger warnings and safe places.
What about the topic of says the University of Chicago says we do not cancel invited speakers because their topics might prove controversial. Joni brought up Donald Trump. Would you be okay? Is there anyone whose presence on your campus or your child's campus is anyone out of bounds to speak on that campus?
Well, the very simple answer to somebody who somebody thinks is out of bounds is don't show up at that event or that class. You have that knowledge. You're going to find them so objectionable. Stay home, study for your test, read your book.
I think it's scary that students will try to block a speaker from coming because they don't agree with her views, whether it's Condoleezza Rice or anyone else. I think that's really, really troubling, and frankly, a much more troubling development in the last several years than the trigger warning concept.
I think there is speech that can go too far, but it's pretty narrowly defined in the law. And other than that, the answer to offensive speech is more speech.
Right. Right. Well said.
We've got a space for intellectual freedom and diversity here. Except we all agree that we feel that way.
And
so wait a second.
Joni. Thank you.
Joni has
We're
brought some
safe because of that.
Yeah, some calming, reassuring
I should have brought
bubbles.
The Play-Doh. I'm sorry.
You're listening to KUOW's Week in Review. We're going to get into how the city and when and whether the city conducts so-called sweeps of unauthorized camps. We're going to talk about dog parks, if we can pry away. What is that? Is that Play-Doh?
Oh, it's bubbles.
It's the bubble.
Oh, the bubble-ator from our guests.
Portable.
Hey, Rob McKenna.
I'm out of practice.
Not bad. Stay tuned to the Week in Review.
He feels safer.
You're listening to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Good to have you here along with Eli Sanders at The Stranger, former Attorney General Rob McKenna, Civic Cocktail host Joni Balter, covering the news of the week and bringing in props if necessary.
We're still blowing bubbles here
in Seattle. We're going to talk now about how the city is getting at its homelessness crisis, because this week homeless advocates wrote an open letter to the city, quote, if people are living in a location that is neither unsafe nor unsuitable, and there are no hazardous or emergency situations, the letter goes on to basically say the city can offer these people services, encourage them to move to a shelter or a tent camp, but you can't forcibly remove people and their stuff unless you can offer them stable services that can lead to housing. Joni, should the city leave unauthorized camps alone unless they are demonstrably dangerous, et cetera?
Well, let's put it like this. I feel like the city is really bumbling and changing on its homeless policy. You know, one day we're told by the mayor that he really, really wants to clean out the jungle. It's an unsafe place. Then they sort of pull back and they don't know what to do. Really what they had, as far as I'm concerned, they had an Excel spreadsheet problem, if you think about it, if you read the Seattle Times piece. They could not get the outreach workers to coordinate in a time way to the day that they were doing a so-called cleanup or a sweep. And so instead of that, you have all these groups coming in and saying, well, we know better what the policy should be. The rollout was a mess. Fix the rollout is where I go.
Isn't one problem with the emergency workers and outreach workers is that they've got lots of demands on them and things don't happen on a strict timetable when you're talking about human beings in any situation, much less a chaotic
situation? Well, why can't it happen on a timetable that works, that makes sense, so that when you go into a very delicate situation where people are already, you know, feeling terrible that they're being moved out and you're discussing services and you're discussing new shelter, why can't, for sure, an outreach worker be there ready to help? What is so hard about scheduling that? Just fix that. That's a mess.
I also think, unfortunately, we are trying this for the first time, and so we're seeing how hard it is to bring together a kind of network of services from different agencies, really, and from the state and the city, and probably the county is involved also. And so, yeah, there has been bumbling, but also here we are in 2016 for the first time trying to have a coordinated outreach approach to people who are living outside in the city. There's something very unfortunate about that, and I wish that the outreach was better. I'm not surprised it's chaotic, given how little attention we've paid to this before.
I think that those are good points, and I would add the following: that, you know, there's a learning curve here, and I don't think we should draw too many conclusions from, you know, the first round of sweeps, where they are figuring it out how to do it right. Number two, I think it does make sense to perform triage. Some are worse than others, and they should be prioritized, and the people there should be prioritized for services, as opposed to a location where there are tents set up and things seem to be going pretty well. You know, the tent cities that have been set up under permit should obviously be allowed to remain because they seem to be working pretty well. That includes the tent city down around the King County Courthouse, City Hall. But other places like the jungle are just so awful. I don't think that in good conscience we should leave them in place, even though not all those people are immediately going to transition to permanent housing. I just think that it's just too dangerous and too risky for the people who are living there and the people who live around those places. So prioritize, perform triage, and give the workers some time to learn how to do this and do it better.
Do you think
is the opposite of what this proposed new law would do. It would not allow the city to kind of triage in the way that you're talking about, or to clear out the jungle, say, just because a determination is made that it's unsafe. It narrows the ability for the city to go in and just clean a place out. And I think the sort of philosophical idea behind it is, if people are living outdoors, the burden is on the city or the state to provide them somewhere else to go before kicking them out.
Yes, but Eli, the law should come from the mayor and the city council. That's what we hired them to do. That's their job. And they should come up with the way they're going to do this. And we thought they were inventing the way they were going to handle this, but then they botched it.
Yeah,
so
I'm not disagreeing with that.
But let them handle it. We elect them to do this.
Yeah,
if they can't, we could get somebody who could.
Sure. Although I also think that's more complicated than we make it seem. And just to be clear, I was just articulating the proposal that came forward from homelessness advocates and or advocates for the homeless and other people who are concerned about the what they feel is the aggressiveness of the sweep. I just see this not to create a sense of, oh, we can't do anything, but just to have a broader context. I see this as incredibly complicated and a very complex problem to solve. And there's a lot of, honestly, I think a lot of people in Seattle feel bad about what's going on in the city in terms of rising homelessness. And some of that bad feeling and guilt gets then projected onto the city officials and like, you do something and you do something now.
I don't know what to do, but you better do something. And if you don't do it in a way that makes me feel good, I'm going to be mad, but I'm not going to solve it. And that kind of, that results in an impatience that does not reflect, like, go way, way upstream, right?
That is very interesting. Anytime we start getting at how people, why, what's really behind some of our passions or our identities, I think we're on to something.
But also, what's really behind the spike in the number of people who are homeless in the city? Well, one is rising inequality. That's something that's maybe hard for a city official to solve with the snap of a finger. But another is cuts over many, many years to state services. And we have this fight as if it exists entirely within the bubble of Seattle or King County, but actually our inattention to what's been going on in Olympia over years and decades contributes to the problem. You have people who are there with mental health issues, drug addiction issues, and what has the state been doing over many years? Cutting funding for helping people in those situations.
But what about an ounce of credit to the Seattle voters who just a few weeks ago said we'll spend double what we have been spending on affordable housing?
That's
great. We want to help. We are committed to this. We do want to put money down.
A key to these homeless advocates for the homeless saying you don't get to just sweep people out, the what's behind that is we don't have enough places for people to go when we tell them you can't be here. So do you see a time when Seattle has enough available shelters that people are willing to go into?
I think it's unlikely because the demand seems to rise with the available space. People learn about the availability of the housing. They come from elsewhere to take advantage of it, which is fine. But it means that you're probably always going to have some people who can't get in. We see that around the country, not just here in Seattle. I think that the middle ground is to provide spaces that can be used for outdoor living in tents that are safe, that have porta potties, et cetera. But here's the problem. We know from the interviews that have been done with some of the people who live in the jungle, they don't like those places because there are controls there. And they aren't just controls imposed by government. The people who live in them police themselves. In fact, when I was on the county council and we were talking about tent cities, one of the selling points to allow tent cities is that the residents police themselves. They put standards in place. Not everyone who lives in the jungle wants to have to live under any rules at all, and so they won't move into those places.
Well, so the one thing about the so-called jungle is that there people are living under this freeway far away from sight. And so if you want more sanctioned places for people to live, where do those go? Because we hear neighbors complaining about needles and noise and criminal activity.
You do see many neighborhoods. I just recently read a letter to the editor from someone from Magnolia saying that, all this money is going to this problem, and yet they still have troubles in their neighborhood. And so this is very delicate. Look, the mayor's been working pretty hard on this. I don't, want to only say he's not putting effort in here. He is. And he has been trying very hard. He declared the emergency. He's bringing, some business help in. He's certainly bringing political cachet to this issue. It's very complicated. They're working on it. They made some mistakes, and they need more help. And the voters were there with the money, and the locating of it is probably the trickiest part. I would say it is.
Well, just to be clear, I think the affordable housing levy, I'm not sure how much housing is in there for people who are moving out of someplace like the jungle. I think a lot of that if I understood it right, it was focused on people who are working, who have jobs and are...
So you don't want them to slip into homelessness.
I don't, but it's not a solution for people who are already homeless necessarily, which just gets back to the point about how difficult this is to solve. The city needs money for affordable housing. It needs to build more housing. It needs to find housing that's free, essentially, and fully staffed with people who can offer whatever services a person may need. That's wonderful. It's a great expression of our liberal ideology, but it is not cheap.
We referred to discarded needles, which brings me to something else that happened this week. you know, if you have a home, you can use whatever drugs you want in the privacy of your home. Members of, maybe not legally, but in reality. This week, members of a task force called for Seattle and King County to become America's first places to provide a safe site or sites for people to use heroin with professionals there to give them clean needles, medical care, and treatment advice. This happens now in Vancouver, BC. Let's start with Attorney General Rob McKenna. Would the federal government let us sanction heroin use?
Well, I don't think that they would let you use federal money in any shape or form. Whether they would enforce federal law against the people operating it is another matter. We've seen the Department of Justice decline to enforce federal law against medical marijuana, for example.
And regular recreational marijuana.
And that's right. That's right. Both. So it may be they would choose not to exercise their prosecutorial power here.
Joni, what do you think about this idea?
You know, I find it pretty tricky. I think we have to be very careful how far we go on this. I could see a pilot project testing the idea. It's based on the 1811 where yes. You know, housing where folks can also. If they haven't solved their alcohol problem, they're still there, but there are services on site and available to kind of help slowly nudge people off.
Well, there's housing, that wet housing, or there's all kinds of different names. There's housing, and then there's also just a drop-in place where you can go in a
right, which is
clinical,
what Vancouver provides. It, right.
Yeah, so I'm into sort of like a pilot project on that, and the thought is that we're not exactly crushing it on our handling of our existing homeless problems, so there would be a concern about how much, you know, how many folks we'd be attracting to come here because we're viewed as, you know, easy on this. Mm. But not to be harsh about that, so try a pilot project, see if it helps or hurts.
Another thing we should point out is that there are demonstrated benefits to programs like this when it comes to wet housing, and a benefit in the realm that people seem to care most about in our politics, money. You can show that wet housing actually saves the government money in terms of emergency calls to deal with people passed out in the street or other kind of late interventions in their lives. So if you can set aside a kind of knee-jerk reaction to, oh, we shouldn't be enabling drunks, which I think is basically what the knee-jerk reaction is, and get behind a harm reduction approach to people who are chronic inebriates and chronic IV drug users, then you actually have an opportunity to maybe help them, although you need to be realistic about how hard addiction is to treat, but also you can save money, and you could take some of that saved money and, you know, put it toward addressing the other big issue, homelessness.
Well, the idea that we shouldn't enable drunks or drug users, it may be knee-jerk. It's also a compassionate one.
I don't know. I mean,
or can be.
It depends on its expression. I think a lot of people would say that the harm reduction approach, which, you know, meets people where they're at and doesn't tell them they have to get off alcohol or drugs completely before they can get housing, that would be the most compassionate approach. Other people would say it's compassionate to just, I don't know, slam the door and say, solve your own problem before we can help you.
I think you're onto something there, Eli. Policymakers are very uneasy about appearing to condone or about being accused of even encouraging people to use heroin or to be chronic public inebriates, public drunks or private drunks. It makes them very uneasy because they worry that they're facilitating this bad behavior by providing comfortable housing for them. That was a discussion we had at the county council when we decided to move forward with the city to do the 1811 housing, the so-called wet housing. And it's really proven out. It's been successful fiscally, from a humanitarian standpoint. I don't think it has resulted in a big increase in the number of alcoholics in our city. Now we come to heroin. Heroin is tougher. This is a felony for one thing. It's a felony. It's terrible, terrible stuff. Extremely addictive. You know, not everyone who drinks alcohol becomes an alcoholic, thank goodness. But people who use heroin at all regularly become addicted to it. It's highly addictive. And so there's this deep-seated fear that if we take steps like providing safe injection sites or housing or both, that somehow we're going to encourage people, facilitate people becoming addicted to this terrible substance. I think the answer is in the data. Let's look at what actually happens. I would like to know a lot more about what's happening, what's been happening in the last decade in Vancouver, for example, not only in terms of the impact of safe injection sites on addiction rates, but, you know, are more people coming to Vancouver as a result of knowing those facility services there? Meanwhile, the concept of giving housing to people who are addicted to heroin or crack, actually, I think is less of a problem for me as I think about it as a policymaker than the injection sites are, because I'd rather have them in safe, clean housing where services are available than out on the street, frankly. I just can't quite get there on safe injection sites yet.
So, and going back to something Eli said here, you know, anything emergency is super expensive on the government that has to pay for it. It's just very, very costly. There's another city we should be talking about, and that's Salt Lake City, where they do the housing first. Same idea as 1811. They put people in housing first and realize that they're saving on all those expensive emergency costs. And so that sort of, you know, fuels my interest. This is something that homeless folks throughout the country are, you know, saying Salt Lake City's a bit of a model and that we should be listening to their data.
And it's actually an answer to the question that was raised earlier. Could we ever build enough housing for all the homeless people in Seattle? Well, that actually is what Salt Lake City does or aims to do, that no one should want for housing.
What if the last question, what if the data did show us somehow that heroin users were attracted from outside of Vancouver into Vancouver because of this safe injection site? Does that mean we shouldn't do it?
It makes it trickier. It does, because we already have a homeless population that our leaders are trying to get their arms around. They're bumbling, and they're still trying to do better by it.
Anyone disagree with that?
I think it's part of the data set you want to look at. You want to be careful about unintended consequences, at a minimum, because you'd want to design your model in a way to minimize those if they can't be avoided altogether.
And at the same time, someone has to go first, and that person or that city will, if your theory is correct, and I'm not even sure it is, but if it does become a magnet, whoever goes first will face that challenge.
Yeah, not my theory. I'm wanting to know what. We're going to learn more, right? We're going to study what's happening in Vancouver, and we might see it. We might be the first here in Seattle and King County. Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, Rob McKenna, Bill Radke with you, and right back with a couple more topics on the Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle has a new plan to fix up dog parks, and it's not enough for dog advocates. KUOW's Paige Browning talked with Ellen Escarcega with the group COLA, Citizens for Off-Leash Areas. They want more dog parks, special hours at public parks when dogs can run free, and another dog beach. There's only one now at Magnuson Park.
We've heard about three-legged dogs who are prescribed swimming from their vets in order to build their muscle tone, and they can only swim in Magnuson. Or if you have a service dog, the Magnuson Beach is not ADA accessible. And equity issues of, you know, I live in Rainier Beach and it takes me 4 miles to get to a dog park.
She says when people don't have off-leash areas nearby, they let their pets run free at other public parks.
Joni, you have a problem with giving dog owners more parks and more beachfront?
I don't have a problem with it, but I think we should look at the context of what's going on. We do have 14 fenced off-leash areas so far. There is the ability here for communities to add more dog parks, but there's, you know, look, what is the best use of parks? Something that allows the maximum number of users to benefit from that parkland. And so
if you multiply the users' legs in that situation, really you could argue the dogs have even more right.
Yeah, even more right there. So, look, off-leash people seem to want, off-leash parks within walking distance. To do that, you know, Seattle's not going to end up doing that. It's going to have to be way, way more of a compromise. The idea of adding another beach, to be specific to this point of it, is that it's very difficult to manage all the interests on the beach. There's what they call user conflicts in park department speak. You have bird areas, you have, some of the plant life that has to be taken care of in a more careful way than having dogs run there.
We've got more dogs in this city than children, and we got lots of play structures. Rob, do you have a problem with more space for the dogs to run?
I don't. Joni referred to off-leash people. For the record, I don't think I don't think people should be let off their leashes. But
nor do I. My brother was on one, and it was a good decision.
That is the most concise encapsulation of republicanism I've ever heard.
No, that's the nanny state, Eli.
Well, a playground is an off-leash area for human children.
For children, that's true. No, look, I think it's, as Joni suggests, it's a balancing act. I mean, there's nothing wrong conceptually or in principle with having more areas for dogs to run around without leashes or to use the beach. The question is, what is the impact on other users? And I say that as someone who likes to use the Merrimore off-leash area for our dogs and the Mercer Island Luther Burbank Park as well. And we should allow that as long as it doesn't result in other people not being able to use the parks as much as they would like to with their kids, with their families. And that's a tricky balancing act. And what happens in politics is that one group can be very, very well organized and very politically savvy and can talk about three-legged dogs who need therapy. That's just brilliant. And as a result,
not,
from a campaigner, tip of the hat from a veteran campaigner.
Oh, did you see the image in your mind? Tell me you didn't see that image in your mind when she spoke of the three-legged dog.
Yes.
So what happens sometimes is that you don't find the right balance because a very highly organized group gets its way more than the folks who aren't as organized. So we have to be. So this is where we rely on our city council members to get it right, to find that right balance.
I think we have to deal with with our feelings of entitlement here too, don't we? I mean, did you catch what Paige Browning said about dog owners there?
She says when people don't have off-leash areas nearby, they let their pets run free at other public parks.
That's what the person from COLA says. I can confirm that that's true, but how annoying is that?
Yeah, that we're held hostage to the unwillingness of some dog owners to abide by the law if they don't get their way completely.
Right, they're just going to let them off leash wherever they want, you are.
And would anyway if there were more parks.
Mm. And I have to say here, I grew up with dogs. We were just talking about how maybe that's not...
Was this your cred portion of
your
answer?
This is my cred. Some of my best friends are dogs.
Yeah.
But when you said COLA, Citizens for Off-Leash Areas, I got a flashback and looked it up. One of the very first stories I ever wrote as a very new journalist in Seattle was about Citizens for Off-Leash Areas fighting to create the dog park in Magnuson Park. And so I, very early on in writing about Seattle, met these people, and they are a force. But
the power of big dog in this town.
Yeah, or the power of three-legged dog.
Mm.
But here we are.
25 dogs let off of one truck with a dog walker.
Sure.
Oh, interesting.
Right. Here we are, one segment after we were talking about how to solve the city's homelessness problem and humans who need a lot of help in the city and are not getting it, talking about whether we're going to create another dog park for three-legged dogs. And then when you're like, I know they're not all three-legged dogs, but that's the image.
We were going to have a class after this.
When you're dealing with a government with scarce resources, you got to make decisions. I think I saw that this new park would cost $500 million or would be part of a $500 million
sounds
program.
Isn't it just like a beach?
There's a $500,000 plan over the next 5 years.
Yeah. Okay. Even $500,000 is a significant amount, would buy a significant amount of housing, say. Pay for intervention counselors for homeless people, all kinds of things that we say we want. And so when I see the city wasting so much time on a debate like this and also thinking of spending so many precious resources, I just think where are our priorities?
Eli, it's the right argument to make. It's about priorities. And as I sit here listening to you make that argument so well, looking at your bicycle helmet sitting in front of me on the table and thinking about the same kind of argument that's made in transportation funding debates about whether or not, you know, the minority of cyclists, and I'm a cyclist too, I don't ride as much as you do, but, you know, are getting more than their share and at the expense of people who want to ride, you know, want to be in their cars.
I like bicycles. I grew up with bicycles, okay?
Some of my best friends are bicycles.
I have a three-legged bicycle.
That's an interesting point, though. There is an entitlement partnership there, isn't there? Bike owners who will go through stop signs and dog owners who will let their dog off leash even when they're not supposed to, whether you like it or not.
Owning a dog does not reduce our carbon output. Mm. You know, owning a dog does not help the environment.
If you smelled my dog, you know that's categorically correct. It definitely does not reduce carbon output.
Sure.
So here's an important point about this. on-leash dogs are welcome in Seattle parks. At most locations in Seattle parks, I think, excepting children's play areas and ball fields. Huh. So we're not talking about, oh, let's be anti-dog here. We're talking about, you know, where can they be off-leash running themselves, you know, without supervision.
Right. We're talking about how hard is it to put a leash on your dog.
Yes, we are speaking of that.
When you're hiking, apparently it's very hard because I've been there.
Yeah, which, you know, don't get me started. That's obnoxious and inconsiderate to have your dog running up and down a trail when it's not supposed to be.
Especially when it's a narrow trail and there's a steep drop-off, so you're not really allowed to move away from the dog.
And not everyone has consented, speaking of safe spaces, to being on the trail with your sometimes scary dog.
You know, Bill, I don't want to read your comments.
Yes, that's where I'm going. I want to invite dog owners, okay? What are we missing here? We're tweeting at KOW. We're on Facebook and record at KOW.org as well. So should Seattle be more of a safe space for teriyaki coming up? KUW's Week in Review with Rob McKenna, Eli Sanders, and Joni Balter. Philadelphia has the Philly cheesesteak. Chicago has deep dish. Or the Chicago dog, that's another argument. Seattle had teriyaki, especially in the 80s and 90s. The New York Times called it a signature Seattle dish. And we still have it, but on the website Thrillist, Naomi Tomke wrote that teriyaki restaurants are closing because New Seattle isn't into it.
If you're a newcomer to the city and you walk down a block and there's an Ethan Stoll pizza restaurant and a Tom Douglas restaurant, and then there's a hole-in-the-wall teriyaki shop, and you have the means to pay for that pizza, you're not going to choose the teriyaki shop. It's probably dingy. There's probably sauce stains on the walls.
Eli, in this gilded age, should cheap Seattle teriyaki be a source of pride?
Yes. I mean, especially in this gilded age when we just finished a very long and hard fight for the $15 minimum wage. If you're earning $15 an hour or anything, you know, within that realm, teriyaki is a great, affordable, and more healthy than other choices lunch. It was a working class culinary tradition in Seattle, as I saw it, in addition to many other things. And it's a sign of the way this city is shifting that it's disappearing.
Should we hang on to uphold the Seattle teriyaki? It could be our Philly cheesesteak if we care for it.
It could be disappearing because of economics, but it could also be disappearing because of changing tastes. I don't know that going to my local pho restaurant is that much more expensive than going to teriyaki. I do agree teriyaki is a good value. I mean, you know, calorie for calorie in terms of health, it is. But how much of this is just about changing taste, and how much of this phenomenon is the fact that people are finally rebelling against that terrible iceberg lettuce?
Yeah, that's not a salad.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
That is a problem.
I heard you, Bill, don't love it's the teriyaki.
Yeah, it's too. It is too sweet for me. Although I had some at the Korean place. They sell teriyaki down the street. The day that I had that, I did that interview because I kind of was. I was saying it's too sweet, and I don't want to put teriyaki sauce. Usually, it's on chicken, which is not that interesting. I don't want to put it on a great piece of salmon, so I'm not that into teriyaki. But I had teriyaki lunch that day, and it was less sweet and better than I remembered.
It's about gentrification. So every time one of these new buildings goes up, they can put in a restaurant on the bottom that charges more for lunch than the teriyaki place.
And therefore can pay more in rent to the developer that's now charging more in rent for those ground floor retail spaces.
So Eli, you're saying eat teriyaki, keep teriyaki local, keep Seattle weird.
Yes. Yeah. I was trying to think of how I could connect that. The opposite of the lesser teriyaki.
Right, man. Yeah, right.
But, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, we didn't have that many food trucks when the teriyaki craze took off. Now we have lots of food trucks. They're fairly cheap to operate. They're not beholden to building owners. And I've noticed not very many of them serve teriyaki. Instead, they're serving an amazing variety of really tasty food that people are apparently looking for.
Sorry, teriyaki. Hey, one more thing. Speaking of local food, the State Ferry System cut ties with its food vendor, Olympic Cascade, in favor of a new vendor from Connecticut. The Connecticut company says, we'll be local, we'll set up in Bremerton, we'll bring in Beecher's cheese and Uli's sausage from the market and Hempler's meat. But Olympic Cascade is petitioning the state to reconsider. Rob, former attorney general of this great state, does a state owe Olympic Cascade anything? Should we have stuck with them because they're local?
No, I don't think so. But of course, the irony here is that the most expensive part of the ferry system is the ferries, and you can't buy those from out of state. Maybe they're misplaced. If the legislature directed the ferry system to go out and put this out to bid, get the best deal they could for ferry riders, which is the right thing to do, but they refuse to do that when it comes to actually building the ferries, and that is kind of ironic.
Yes, Joni, should the ferry system at least stay local in its galley?
I'm not so hung up on whether it came from Connecticut business folks or local, but the food on the ferries, I mean, talk about an audience that wants food at different times of the day. The food on there is pretty awful. And so if these Connecticut folks or these local folks, doesn't matter to me, come in and provide food that people here like, local, like Beecher's cheese and that kind of stuff, go for it.
But Eli, here's my quick pitch, though. Do we need, this reminds me, I have friends who bring their marinated cuts of beef to the camp, to camping with me, and they and with ice packed in the cooler so that it keeps the craft beer cold. To me, camping is the one place you just open up a can of chili. I'm on a ferry for how long? You know, do I really need to glamp? Do I need
long
to be
enough.
Ferry fabulous? Does everything need to be high end?
No, and I was going to make a humble proposal for teriyaki.
Oh.
Oh, merge the two stories.
Excellent. But ferryaki.
Yes, sold.
Ferryaki.
Okay. Is there anything more to say after we've said the word ferryaki?
No, I think that is the solution to all things that we've discussed today.
Okay. Eli Sanders, associate editor of The Stranger, author of While the City Slept, the Pulitzer Prize winning While the City Slept. Great to see you again.
Great to see you.
Rob McKenna, former attorney general for Washington State and King County Council member and gubernatorial candidate. And what's next for you?
Dog owner.
Dog owner, Rob McKenna. Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Great to see you, too.
Great to see you.
Thanks for running down the news of the week. We'll do it again next week right here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information.